Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, especially today, a.k.a. Helen Mirren Stalker, a.k.a. a bunch of different aliases. And welcome to another fabulous installment of Motherfuckers I Know, the only podcast where you'll find me talking to motherfuckers I know, because basically I'm lonely.
And I think that was the original name of the Tonight Show, but they had to change it.
Yeah, I guess they, you know, I guess Jack Parr wasn't into that, but I don't know what you want to say or something like that. But the other person on the end of this conversation, once again, hit me up via Skype. And it's been a long time coming, getting this man on the Krizzlecast. He is a very well-known film and television critic, a mentor to many young scribes like myself. You can catch him over there at New York Magazine, and he started the Press Play, one of the chief architects of the Press Play blog over at IndieWire.com. Matt Zollersites, welcome to the goddamn Krizzlecast. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, Craig.
Yeah, it's good having you. You know, once again, we're doing this old school and having this conversation on my digital voice recorder, because I was trying to, I had the Skype MP3 recorder happening, and I still don't know how to work that, so I'm going to have to call up a couple more savvier podcasters and try to figure out why the hell that's working. Have you done podcasts like these often, Matt?
Audio only. I've never done a video one, but I've done some audio ones.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get the hang. This is a very low maintenance podcast, low rent. You know, I'm on.
You didn't have the Fly Girls this time. There were some budget issues, I guess.
No, I guess not. Jeez, well, Fly Girls. Yeah, have not heard that reference in quite a while.
All my references are from the 80s. You know that.
Yeah, 80s, 90s. You know, wherever you want to swing it, but I guess we should get into the last time we actually kind of saw each other face to face. When I was in your apartment or establishment, because back in 2007, I got the News and Observer to foot the bill to send me to New York for the New York Film Festival. I was there for a week to check things out, and I was asking around on the interwebs. See if there's any people in New York that would that could house me. If they had a futon, I could crash. And you were that person. Which, by the way, I think as I told you many times, people are still blown away by that. And I'm still blown away by that because we didn't know each other that well.
Well, we sort of did. I read your writing, and we corresponded online, and you seemed like a nice guy, so, you know. I had heard any reports that you were, like, a serial killer. That came out later, but, you know, everything was cool. Yeah.
Well, you know, statute of limitations. But, it was, like, an interesting thing that, you know, I had, you know, that you let me stay in your home with your children's.
Craig?
Yeah?
Sorry, your transmission was interrupted, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Staying in your home with your children's.
Yes.
Your daughter, who I remember used to sing all the time. And
yes, she still does, actually.
She still does. And, like, how are the kids, actually?
They're doing great. My son, James, is 8. My daughter's 15 now. She's going to Frank Sinatra High School in Queens, and she's studying to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So she's making movies and editing stuff, and it's pretty great.
Yeah, so it was just, I'm guessing you had a lot to do with that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, she might have sort of through osmosis absorbed some of that, but she always was a very avid movie viewer. In fact, you know, I remember her at age 5 sitting there watching The Graduate along with me, which was fine until all of a sudden I realized that it's not a movie suitable for a 5-year-old.
Yeah, well, you know.
And had to shoo her away, but yeah.
I saw Andy Warhol's Frankenstein at 4, so it's just like, yes, we've all had those experiences.
We have.
And just remember seeing a woman washing her titties in the sink. And I'm just like, even that, yeah, I think I'm supposed to see that.
I can't remember what my first R-rated movie in a theater was. Probably Alien. But, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, that was the era when all bets were off, and, like, PG-rated movies, a lot of them were kind of like R-rated movies.
Yeah.
See people, like, smoking pot and doing cocaine, and there's a pretty good chance if you bought a ticket to see a movie made between 1975 and 1985, you'd see a topless woman, probably a blowjob joke, something like that. It's kind of extraordinary when you look back on it that there's audiences full of little kids.
Oh, yeah, like little stuff like, you know, Slapshot, I believe, was rated. Was Slapshot rated PG or something?
I think that was rated R for language. Oh, okay. I did it through the magic of Google. And now the only thing that's left in PG-13 movies really is the violence. They made sure to leave that in, but all the stuff is gone.
Well, I remember, you know, my first, you know, when I first saw Airplane, such a big fan of that movie. Oh, yeah, and there was that moment, that moment panicky, when just a woman's breath, like, just walked in the frame.
They completely fill up the frame, and I love that because that, to me, is the first sort of instance of a movie commenting on that particular cliche of that time.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I mean, that is the most gratuitous shot of its kind in American movies, and that's what makes it so funny.
Yeah, it was just like, just set in
the plane, and all of a sudden,
everybody's losing their mind, and there's titties. It's just, interesting. But yeah, looking back when I stayed over, and it just, once again, it's still one of those things I still tell people about, just the experience. Because, of course, when I bring up that I stayed at your place, particularly you, people are like, oh man, what is he like? Like, you seem to have, and also, I was going to say this for later on.
You didn't tell about me sleeping upside down from, like, Batman, did you? You left that part out.
I don't remember you sleeping at all. That was one thing, because, yeah. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and you'd still be writing.
I get that a lot.
Yeah, just like, what are you doing? Because even now, because I read that you're like, you stay up at night and write 2-3 pieces in one night, and I'm just like, geez, how the hell does he get the stamina?
I don't really know. That's always been that way. I wrote 3 pieces yesterday, actually, and I'm writing, after I get off here with you, I'm probably going to write a piece or two. But I like to write, man. What can I say? And it's funny. I'm like writing for Vulture in New York now, and they ask for a lot, but I somehow still feel like I need to write more. Maybe it requires an intervention. I don't know.
Well, I especially now, considering the job that you have, you are the TV critic, for New York Magazine, and you write pieces for their blogs, for their Vulture blog and all that. And actually, something I wanted to get into, because for people who know you, you wrote a lot about TV for the Star Ledger, yeah. And you were quite prolific there, while at the same time doing movies for New York Press.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's one of the things I always admire about you. I guess that's why I hit you up looking for a place. So, like, oh, I can go over to Matt's place and he can talk to me all about, how he manages. Because that was, like, one of those things where I think I talked to you near the end where... Yeah. We discussed how's it like just writing about movies and also writing about TV, and is there that divide between movie critics and TV critics? Even though, like, when I was growing up, you know, the people I most admired from a critical standpoint were those people who had different interests you know, guys like James Wolcott and Elvis Mitchell and Ken Tucker, who could write about movies and TV with the same perspective and actually not, you know, dismissing one or the other. It's like talking in the same sense, you know, and just so, you know, I always find that it's funny when people don't even know that I can write about movies or music or TV. Was saying, like, when people find out, oh, you write about music too, like, how do you do that when you also write about movies? You know, just like, I can write about other things.
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly they're two very big mediums. It's not possible to, you know every single thing that's going on. I mean, there's entire, my knowledge of international cinema is, I guess, better than the average guy on the street, but there's probably entire countries where I've never seen one film from there, and you know, entire television networks that I never write about. So, you know, I'm not insane enough to think that I can cover everything. You do have to specialize, but as far as the divide goes, there was a divide when I first started writing about television in 1997 for the Star Ledger. I was a pop culture columnist for a couple of years before that, and I was concurrently a television critic for the Star Ledger alongside Alan Sepinwall and a critic at New York Press with Godfrey Cheshire and Armin White. I remember I got in a lot of arguments with Armin and Godfrey about particular television series that were on at the time, that, you know, this in the late 90s, early aughts, and things like Deadwood and Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Sopranos and so forth, The Wire, you know, The Shield, and later Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and so forth. And not just those guys, but a lot of my film critic colleagues some of them liked The Sopranos, but that was about it. And HBO at that time was sort of the equivalent of, in an early era, saying, I don't watch television except for PBS. Mm-hmm. You know, that was sort of like, there was like the HBO exception. And on the television side of things, television critics, by and large, respected cinema and respected film critics because it was an older medium. It was about, you know, 50... television really became widespread in the 50s, and cinema really became widespread sometime, maybe 40, 50 years before that. But there was a sense that film critics were snooty. They were smug, they had a superior attitude because they were writing about a more established medium, and I think there was a lot of truth to that. And one of the things that always appealed to me about television was I liked the idea of coming in on a medium that was still in the process of finding its own voice and discovering that it was not just cinema on a smaller screen, and it wasn't just a box with tubes and lights inside, to paraphrase Edward R. Murrow, that it was something else. It had different properties from television, and I think it's still figuring it out. Like, I don't think we're anywhere close to the evolutionary peak that cinema reached in the 60s and 70s, and I love the fact that I get to have this platform where I can talk about what I'm seeing and try to talk about what it might mean. And then there's all this social media happening at the same time, which is astounding, and that seems to click with television in a way that is perfect. And you know, I mean, music fans, movie fans, sports fans, I think actually the closest equivalent is probably sports. I'm not a big sports buff, but the phenomenon of following a team, watching a team play, following a team's behind-the-scenes action, more or less in real time, I think it's very similar to the way people talk about television on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you point out just the whole rep of film critics being snooty and elitist, because you were at the press in the big glory years where it was you and Godfrey and Armin. I think a lot of people, like, whoever listens to this, especially like a lot of people who know you, would very much like you to get into great detail about being a part of that triumvirate of... Because it seemed like you were just like the guy... you were the guy that didn't mind reviewing the blockbuster films. I mean, I remember also, we should also point out that Godfrey Cheshire, like, he was a film critic for New York Press, but he was also a film critic for Raleigh Spectator.
That's right.
And for a long while there, while he was up in, I don't know, Iran doing something, I don't know.
He was working on a book and some other things.
Yeah. You pinch hit it for him up for the Raleigh Spectator.
I did.
And it was funny just reading, reading his pieces and then reading yours, because you would be the one that would, and this was in the late 90s, you'd be the one that write about Speed 2, G.I. Jane, and all the different films that I don't think Godfrey would go near.
Yeah, although, the way that happened was I was writing for The Independent. He was writing for The Independent. He left The Spectator and went to The Independent, and he recommended me to replace him at The Spectator. So we were kind of writing simultaneously for different papers. But Godfrey never shied away from the populist stuff either, and you got to give him credit for that. I mean, he was a huge, huge fan of Spielberg. That was one of the most anomalous things about New York press, that Armand and Godfrey and I did not agree on a whole lot, but we all agreed that Spielberg was awesome, and were really, really annoyed that our colleagues in New York, by and large, were suspicious or dismissive of him. And it was weird. It was like we were this weird little club, and we all had this thing in common. But there's somewhere online, there's a roundtable discussion about the films of the 90s, and somebody threw out the question, who is the most important American filmmaker of the 90s? And we all unhesitatingly said, Spielberg, of course. Mm-hmm. And I think we moved on from there.
Yeah.
But it's the rest of the country probably can't relate to that, because Spielberg, he's not as popular now as he used to be, but uh-huh. There was a time where he was like, I don't know what, like Aaron Copland to American classical music in the 40s and 50s, or, Leonard Bernstein slightly later, or, Stephen King to horror in the 80s. I mean, he was the king, he was the boss, and yet in New York, the guy there was always something people were suspicious of with him, that he was too sentimental, too simplistic, too heavy-handed, too whatever. But I look at his movies, and even his worst movies are kind of extraordinary because of the way they're put together and the sensibility they express. I could go into Spielberg and Malick and Michael Mann, and there's a few other directors that I'm just completely obsessed with. Park Chan-wook I'm kind of obsessed with right now, or Chan-wook Park, I guess you're supposed to say. And the Collins,
that's interesting you point that out, because if anything I got from the New York press is that I don't want to say you guys play favorites, but especially with Armand, because it was,
but we did.
Yeah, well, that Armand especially, just like anything that Spielberg or De Palma or Walter Hill, or of course as the time would go on, Adam Sandler would you give just unanimous praise to, nothing could go wrong with him. And it was just like that whole thing with...
Here's the thing about Armand, and I find myself, and this may sound weird, because I think there's a perception that, there was a lot of animosity between the three of us there, and there really wasn't. I mean, we argued about things, we fought about things, we actually did have some pretty severe disagreements over various issues. Some of them work related, others aesthetic, but ultimately, I find myself often in the position of defending Armand, because I think there is a tendency to get sort of distracted by the tone and the style of his writing, and not really think about the content, I'm not just talking about the arguments that he's making, but the filmmakers that he is championing. And there are a lot of cases where Armand was thought to be a raving lunatic, and in time was proven correct, or if not correct, unanimously everybody agrees he was correct. But at least that he was on to something. Maybe he wasn't articulating in a way that spoke to everyone, or perhaps in a way that alienated, almost everybody, but he was on to something. And I think if you give him a fair hearing, I think you can see that that's true. And I think, there's a lot of critics who are like that. Pauline Kael was like that. I think Rosenbaum was like that, although theoretically he's retired, but I feel like there's a new Jonathan Rosenbaum article every week.
Yeah.
he retired. Sinatra did.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you point out Kael, because going back to Spielberg, I mean, I think, wasn't Pauline Kael one of the first people to call out Spielberg for being a sentimentalist with his movies?
Well, Yeah, I wouldn't say call him out. She identified it. And that was one of the things that I really liked, was her saying that this guy is making movies in an old-fashioned style. He's very classical, and yet he's very modern at the same time. And his sensibility... And, you know, it sounds completely, totally bizarre to say this, but... I get that kind of rush from Brad Bird, I think, who actually was a Spielberg discovery. A lot of people forget that.
Oh yeah, yeah, he did Family Dog for Amazing Stories.
Kind of plucked that animated short out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And in fact, the list of careers that Spielberg personally made that turned out to be quite important is a rather long list. I'm trying to be on the lookout for more filmmakers like that, more filmmakers who are derided or distrusted or misunderstood in their own time, but I think there's something distinctive about them. And they don't have to be perfect. They don't have to be respectable. All I care about is that they have a goddamn personality. Have a personality. That's all I care about, really. And you look at the films of Samuel Fuller. I bring this up a lot. Samuel Fuller was not universally regarded as a great and important filmmaker in his time, and in fact, it didn't start to happen until he made the Big Red One in 1981. Yeah. He was getting to be quite an old man. He was around long enough, you know, the line from Chinatown, politicians, whores, and old buildings become respectable if they're around long enough. That's what happened to Samuel Fuller. And now every film fan, every critic that you talk to agrees, oh, Samuel Fuller, he's great and important. That was not a majority opinion when he was actively making movies. So who are the Samuel Fullers out there right now? Who are they? And who is championing them? The people who are a little rough around the edges, maybe a little corny, hysterical, crude, cornball. Who is it? I think Spike Lee probably qualifies. I think, and people, their eyes practically bug out of their head when I say this, but I think Tyler Perry might qualify. I think there's something authentic and real and fucking bizarre about Tyler Perry that's way more interesting to me than, like, you know, say Simon West or somebody like that, you know?
I mean, if we're gonna go around with black filmmakers, a person I always thought has always been underrated and kind of... I've spoken to him several times about his whole thing, is Charles Stone.
Charles Stone III.
Yeah, Charles Stone III, like, who directed...
What's the last thing he directed?
Like, the last thing I remember him doing was Mr. 3000.
I feel like there might have been one more after that, but there was the Mr. 3000, Paid in Full, Drumline.
Yeah.
And I feel like he might have gotten some episodic TV work after that.
Now, he was supposed to direct that Chris Rock movie, I Think I Love My Wife, until they had, like, differences or something. Chris Rock came in or something. And, yeah, so it was kind of like, for a while there, I thought, you know, even when I was watching movies like, you know, Drumline, which, you know, it is kind of that whole populist flair there. I mean, there was some stuff going on there that I thought was quite distinctive and quite, because before Drumline came out, I mean, 2 months before the Miramax finally dropped Paid in Full, which I think was on, of course, on the storied Weinstein shelf, and they finally dropped that, and that actually was a very good movie, I thought.
It was a very good movie, although I think Drumline is for me, his masterpiece. I think that movie is pretty close to perfect.
Yeah. Wow. It's right. Once again, going back, you seem to be the person that would say that.
I don't know, man. I mean, it's only one guy's opinion, but I certainly, you know. And in fact, sometimes I live to regret this, but I certainly, if I get really excited about a movie, for positively or negatively, I do tend to go a little berserk. I mean, to the point where people are like, ratcheted back by 25%, Matt. And there have been times where I've been wrong. I mean, I think everybody's had that incident where you see a movie, you come out of it, you absolutely, completely despise it, or you adore it. You absolutely adore it, if it were person, you'd try to marry it. And then you look at it 10 years later, and you go, why did I have that reaction? This is not, you know, it's not as bad or not as good as I thought. And sometimes it has to do with whatever you're going through at the time.
Yeah.
Critics don't like to admit, but there are some movies where I wrote a review. My first review of In the Mood for Love, I hated it. I really dislike that movie. I can't for the life of me Well, I'll tell you why it was. I think I was probably having some bad stuff going on in my personal life and at work, and like, I think I was just in an unbelievably sour mood when I saw it, and I was probably tired. I don't know. And then I saw it again like 3 months later and thought, what are you, an idiot? This is great.
Yeah.
It happens, you know? It happens.
Well, I think there's a thing that people need to know about critics is just that, especially for about film in general. I mean, I've had this discussion with other critics on more than one occasion where you may feel something about a movie at one point and then it, you know, changed drastically over time. And Sean Burns put it best when he said, like, you know, movies just have this fluid lifespan where, you know, your opinion of it changes throughout time. I mean, perfect example for me was George Washington. When I first saw that, I was dozing off through most of it, and then I saw it a year later, and I thought, oh, I finally get it. It's like after 10 years, I finally got George Washington. And so, movies have their fans. And that's something I realized when I was writing, when I started writing a lot about film. Is that just, you know, because, you know, when you do a review, especially for a daily newspaper or weekly newspaper, you gotta instantly come up with an opinion immediately.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah,
you
know, and it's just also, like,
it's also kind of hard, I find, it's still difficult to write a mixed review. And I find that, what I found, one thing that's very striking to me is that I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I have found that people seem to be less capable of processing and understanding a mixed review than when I was starting out. And I can't tell you how many times in the last 5 or 10 years I've reviewed a film or a television show or something, and there have been certain parts of it that I think are just great, and other parts that are mediocre or terrible. And the parts of the review where I'm describing the stuff I like are extremely enthusiastic, and the parts I'm describing what I don't like are pretty harsh. And people have cognitive dissonance, a lot of them, when they read it, and they say, I don't understand, did you like this or did you not like it? And, the answer is it doesn't need both, and it doesn't have one either.
But I think
you feel that way, too, but I often find myself waiting into the comments section having to explain myself a little further. It's like, no, I'm not schizophrenic. I liked the lead performance and thought the direction was poor, you know?
Well, I think it's a general sense that when you're a critic, you are the instant notifier to people of whether something is good or bad or not. And just, you know, people don't understand. I also think that one of the real problems is just grading movies and rating movies by stars and letters and all that and grades and everything. That just destroyed everything because they have... Does the review have to fit the star rating or the grade? And it got to the point with me where I was just like, listen, don't pay attention to the stars. I would tell people, don't pay attention to any of that. Just
read the review.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I tell people. People tell me, should I see it? I'm like, I don't know, read the review. I mean, you've read enough of my stuff to know whether my taste is similar to yours or not. Just read the review and make your own mind, man. You know, the letter grades and the number grades, I don't think they really help much for me as a viewer because, this is an extremely obscure example, and I don't know why it popped into my head, but about 15 years ago, there was a miniseries on ABC about the Beach Boys.
Okay.
And it was about the history of the Beach Boys. It was very much a pretty conventional network biopic. Not a lot was special about it, except for the lead performance of Frederick Weller as Brian Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
And Frederick Weller, as you know, doesn't look a goddamn thing like Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
He had this horrible blonde dye job. He doesn't look anything like him in the face. And yet, he broke my heart as Brian Wilson. I mean, it was really one of the best performances I've ever seen anybody give on a TV program. And I raved about it, but I made sure to caution people that the miniseries, you know, you got to sit through 2 hours of just okay television miniseries, but I think it's worth it because his performance is brilliant.
Yeah.
And, but how do you indicate that? What do you give it a... I don't feel like I should give something like that a C, because his performance was an A+. What do you do? I like Mike D'Angelo's 1 to 100 scale. I feel like that's a little better, maybe, but I still feel like it's treating it like it's an assignment.
And
I don't know.
And plus, you know, I remember talking to him years ago about that, and he has his whole thing in his head, which was, for me, being a horrible at math, that just didn't fly with me. It was literally, he had just like a whole system of figuring this out.
Yeah,
just like
entire cosmology. I've talked about this with him over the years a little bit too, and he has a very, very elaborate rationale for why it gets a certain grade. But you know, that's what teachers do, and Mike would have made a great teacher.
Yeah.
You know, I think he kind of is one, actually.
Well, yeah, actually, it's interesting you bring him up, because I think I've told you this. I'm kind of on this belief that there are two different types of film critics now. There are critics that pray to the altar of you. There are critics who pray to the altar of D'Angelo. I know, there's like D'Angelo people and there's Matt Seitz people.
That's the first I'm hearing of that. I know there are some people who like me and others who don't like me, but that's, you know... Honestly, I feel like I should be wearing a long white beard as I hear that. Although, I'm getting a little more now just by virtue of having been around, and now I'm writing for a magazine, so I'm establishment.
Yeah.
You know? So that's different vibe. But I did have a conversation about 3 years ago at Ebertfest. I was standing over, at some party talking to some young film student, and we got in the conversation about of the 90s, and we got on the subject of Fight Club, which is a movie that I adored at the time it came out, and I think its respectability has risen a little bit, but I really think that's a great film, and he said, Fight Club, that was a pivotal film of my youth. And I said, your youth? How old?
Yeah.
How old were you when it came out? And he said, 10. And I said, I have to go get another drink. Actually said that.
Of course, you're the elder statesman at this point. And
that's not true. There's a lot of guys who are more elder than me. But you know, the people I look up to, like, you know, Godfrey, Armand, Jonathan Rosenbaum, Manola, Manola's only like 5 years older than me, I think. And, you know, I kind of look up to Tony Scott a little bit, although I think he's my age or younger, but that guy can write.
Yeah.
Really. And there's so many pieces he's written that I wish I'd written. You know, like, my standard joke is when I read something, the highest compliment I can pay to another writer is to say that is so fucking good that I'm not even jealous of it. You know, like where it's kind of on the edge, where you think, like, yeah, maybe I could have written a slightly better review of that movie than that person. But, like, Tony is one of those people who is routinely better than anyone. He's really, really good. And do you remember when he first got that job and everybody was saying, you know, oh, but he's never written really about film that much. He's not qualified. Well, I think the matter's been settled at this point.
Oh, yeah, I mean, and there was a brief moment in time when you actually was in that same circle with Tony and Manola, because you did stuff for the Times.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, what was that experience like for you? Because, yeah, you kind of like fourth tier or something like that?
I was at the Times. Yeah, I was the quote-unquote backup film critic. There were actually several of us, but basically what that meant was Tony and Manola took turns taking a first choice. Stephen Holden, got to pick from whatever they didn't choose, and then what was left over went to the freelancers, of which I was, you know, first in line for the, like, year and a half that I was there. I wasn't even there that long. But it was an interesting experience, let's put it that way. And you know, it did, that and Time Out in New York were very, very good for me in terms of, you know, teaching you how to pack the suitcase. You know, the metaphor that your journalism teacher tells you that when you're writing short, you got to imagine that your house is on fire and you can only put 10 things in the suitcase.
Yeah.
But that's like, and Time Out in New York especially. In fact, Time Out in New York, where I was an editor, I filled in for the late Andrew Johnston on a couple of different occasions for a few months at a stretch, and I had never been a professional magazine editor before, so I learned a lot there. But I also did a lot of writing, and I edited other people's writing. And being able to kind of give the flavor of something in 150 words or 350 words is not easy.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know that cliche, like, I'm sorry, I don't remember who said it, but I apologize for writing you such a long letter, I didn't have time to write a short one. I totally get that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because especially, you know, as being a freelancer myself, just the, you know, blurbs, you know, you instantly get to have a love-hate relationship with blurbs, because you know you have to do them. First of all, just the way it's, just the word blurb, just make everything sound so like, this is what
it's like you're coughing up a phlegm glob or something.
Yeah, just like, can we call it something else?
It's a Cronenbergian sound effect.
Yeah, blurbs are, you know, something that would be said on 30 Rock or something. And, you know, it has to be done. I mean, I've been doing them back and forth. And that's another thing, because I was, I'm doing TV blurbs now for another paper. And, I haven't done TV in quite a while, like a long time, and I'm realizing how, especially when it's your job to write about television,
yeah,
that there, especially now, there's so much out there that it's getting to be overwhelming on a just extreme scale.
Just on a time management level, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. And in fact, I write about film a lot less often than I used to because there is so much to write about on TV where you are expected to have an opinion about particular things. So that is interesting. But the experience of writing about TV, and I've been doing it pretty much exclusively. Well, not exclusively. I did a lot of film writing when I was at Salon also. But, But I would say 75 to 80% of my writing is about television now, and it's different because television is a relationship. It's a relationship. It's ongoing.
Yeah.
And it's just like you have a bunch of different friends, you know, or people you know, people you work with in your life. That's kind of what TV shows are like. Like, you got one show that does this and one show that does that and one show that you've just gotten to know and another that's been in your life for 8 years. And there's these ups and downs, and there are times where, you know, a show that's been on the air for a long time, unless it's a really extraordinary example of quality control, like say Breaking Bad, where it's been consistently pretty great all the way through, you're gonna have times where the show kind of sucks, and you're not getting anything out of it. And also just the organic nature of television is interesting. And, you know, Keith Ulick said to me in a conversation years and years ago, and it really stuck with me, this idea that when you watch a television show, you're not just watching what's on the screen. You're seeing the, you know, you're looking at the performances, the writing, direction, the overall drama. But you're also looking at how they respond to being a television show.
Mm.
And the fact you got to make, for, you know, 10 to 22 episodes a year, you only have 2 to 3 weeks to make an episode. You only have a few weeks to plot out the entire season, and then you got to start writing. You only have a very short amount of time to do editing and post-production. So there's a sense in which this is an improvisation. Like, all television is an improvisation. They're improvising on this freaking gigantic scale.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me. Like, that's exciting. Because, you know, now when I'm knowing that about television and having reported on the industry and knowing how it's made, every time I sit down to watch a TV show, even one that's just sort of okay, kind of on the fence with me, I'm a little excited to see what they're going to do, just knowing what they're up against, you know?
Well, yes, you know, it's, you know, getting back briefly about how there's just so much of that out, so much of all this out here. I mean, I remember when I spoke to Wolcott about his time, right, doing TV for, the Village Voice, and his thing was that, you know, that he just write about the television that not only appealed most to him, but the television, what you're talking about, that just that you had relationships with, just like the shows that he wanted to, like SCTV, wrote about SCTV a lot and wrote about a lot of PBS shows and everything. And but it's just like, but that was back when there's 4 networks, there were 3 networks and PBS, and then there was the 3 UHF channels and stuff, and it's just, I mean, it's just so much, and just like, I'm thinking, like, it's even difficult for you to even be in that position where, you know, you have a relationship with shows and you write about shows a lot, but there's still, but every, like literally every day something pops up on a TV show or on television and you gotta end up writing about that. And or you may end up writing about that, and you feel yourself it may happen to even get a new relationship going. It's almost like you're like juggling different TV shows around, and it's like I'm just trying to see how is it overwhelming for you.
There's time shifting involved. Yeah. It is like that. And you know there are certain shows like what I do is I have a hierarchy. I have the shows that I watch every week, usually on the day that they first run that particular episode. And then there's the other shows that I check in with infrequently. Like I'll watch the first two episodes of the season, then I'll check out for a while, and then I'll come back in around episode 5 or 6, and if there's something interesting going on, I'll go back and fill in the gaps. And then there are the other ones where I know that they are not maybe the most exciting shows in the world for me, but I need to keep track of them in sort of a global sense. And so I will, you know, dip into them occasionally during the season, knowing that I'm not really going to commit. And then I'll come in the summer or whenever the season is over and I'll binge. And I'll watch, like I'll go on Hulu or Amazon or wherever I got to go to see these episodes, and I'll just watch a whole season in one day and then I'm caught up. And I think a lot of people watch TV that way now, actually.
Yeah, it does seem, and it's kind of interesting, just like it does seem that there's this, you're in this perfect time for you, because you write for New York, and then I believe started doing TV for Salon.
Yeah, that was 2009 to 2010. I was writing a lot of television and film stuff for Salon.
And it just does seem that you're at this perfect moment where it seems that TV is worth talking about in such a way where it's just something that you have to do, because it just seems there's just so much out there for you to discover, and it's almost I would assume, especially someone like yourself who seems to be always looking for something different and new and original and fresh, that you're gaining a lot of that more through television instead of movies.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far, because I used to see, you know, an additional whatever television I watched, I saw anywhere from 150 to 250, even 300 movies in a year, like new releases from that calendar year. It was kind of insane looking back on it, but
yeah.
I don't do that anymore, Nick. Now I see maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 movies a month in the theater, like one a week, basically, and you know, that's being generous. It's usually more like a couple a month. And then I'll watch things on TV or on DVD, but, you know, my point is that I don't know enough about current cinema to be able to say yes or no to that, because there might be some, I've seen a lot of stuff recently that I have liked quite a bit on big screens, but I'm being selective. Like, I'm reading other reviews, I'm having a lot of conversations with people who see a lot of movies, and people whose tastes I can sort of judge in relation to my own.
Yeah.
And then I make my decision, because, you know, it's 2 hours to see the movie, it's an hour to get there and an hour to get back, usually.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're giving them 4 hours and maybe $15-$20. And so I try to be a little more selective, and I do try to go to movies that I think there's a reasonable chance that I might like, or at least not hate. You know, and once in a while there'll be an exception where there's a movie that I'm pretty sure, like, just based on the conversations that are happening about it, that I'm probably going to hate it, but I feel like I have to have an opinion on this because I don't want to be shut out of the conversation that's happening, and so I will go see it. And sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised. You know, I didn't expect to like it, and I did, or sometimes the reverse. And, you know, I don't get to see movies I like to see movies more than once if I can, and I don't get to do that so much either. And you know, The Master is an example of that.
Yeah.
I've seen The Master twice now, and I'm kind of wavering. I was very enthusiastic at first, and I saw it a second time, and slightly less so, and I'm feeling like maybe I need one more viewing. It's like, now I've given Paul Thomas Anderson 5 hours of my life this year. Do I want to give him another 2.5?
Well, I mean, were you one of those lucky bastards that saw it in 70mm?
No.
Yeah, well, just maybe.
No, unfortunately, I wish I could say that I had, but no.
Yeah. No. Are they still playing that in millimeter up in New York?
Yeah, I don't know if they are or not, but, you know, I am actually going through a sort of really intense 35mm love fest phase, because I feel like we're in the waning days of 35mm projection, and so I am to the point now where, and my friends will testify to this, they'll say, hey, Matt, you want to go see such and such a movie? And I'll say, are they projecting it on film? That's actually a factor for me, because I feel like I don't want to be going to a theater right now, knowing that 35mm is still happening. I don't want to be going to a theater if it's not 35, unless I have no choice. There's some theaters where you really don't have a choice. Like, the only place to see it is at this theater, and they don't show film. Well, yeah. You deal. But I want to be able to say, I saw this on 35, I saw that, I saw this other thing. And I took my daughter to see 48 Hours at a midnight show, and I thought it was going to be a 35 print, and they showed a Blu-ray. And it was fine. We had a perfectly good time. But I was kind of annoyed that it wasn't 35 the whole time. That's what a geek I'm turning into about this 35 issue. And I love digital. I mean, it's fine. It's just, it's what cinema is turning into. But, you know, this is something beautiful that is fading, and we have to appreciate it while it's here.
Can I just say how, just the fact that you, an idea of a father-daughter bonding experience is going to the theater and seeing 48 Hours. Well, first of all, I'm pretty sure you just made Sean Burns moist when you just said that.
Well, she was pretty good, actually. She noticed, you know, I had a great moment with her where, you know, Jonathan Banks is in that.
Yeah.
And he has one great scene at the beginning, you know, God damn it, Jack, don't you do it. And he's on Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad is my big show with Hannah right now. We watch when Breaking Bad is on, we watch it every week, and sometimes we'll watch it twice, you know, and she calls it a father-daughter bonding through drug-related violence. But I have to go. I'm going to have to go now, because I got to...
Oh, really? Yeah. There's, so much stuff. I wanted to discuss, like, your, you know, because, of course, because, you know, you're from Texas, you know, you started out in Texas and everything, and I'm from Texas, too, it's just that. So I don't know if you want to do, like, a part two or something.
I'll tell you what, I'm happy to do it again. Let's plan it, and let's do it.
Okay, well, I guess we can pause now, but then, like, we can plan it again, and then it'll be, like, all in one different episode, but,
However you want to do it, man, but I gotta go. I just looked at the clock and realized I'm gonna be in serious trouble if I don't do this, so.
Okay, well, we will do this part two on another occasion. I actually have to do part two with somebody else. But, yeah, the part two, so, yeah, we'll definitely keep this going.
Okay.
All right, but, you know, you go and work and do all that stuff, and thanks a lot for taking part in this. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, man. I see you.